Charles, very good to have you here. We have a big panel right now, and I'm going to start to bring on. Do you want to like introduce people, and then we'll like dramatically push them onto the screen?
I love that. Yeah. To thunderous applause. Yeah. Thank you, Adam. So I guess I'll start by introducing our first panelist, Shamala Priyaga, who is a senior software product manager at NVIDIA. She's done some great work on voice assistance and I'm looking forward to hearing from her about how LLMs have changed that landscape.
Nice. Shamala, I think you're here.
Great. Keep on bringing folks on the stage. Next up, we have Sahar, who is currently doing product at Stripe, has worked as an engineer and an engineering manager, which is exciting. The topic of this panel is product engineering for language models. So at this intersection of making a useful product people like and making a computer do stuff when it doesn't want to, we got a lot of folks with that intersection of skills. And Sahar is one of them. I'm excited to have him on.
Hey everyone, great to be here. And I just left Stripe a few weeks ago, but same knowledge I'd like to share. So,
Awesome. You're still wearing the shirt. All right. And then next up, we have Sarah Guo, who is founder of Conviction, a VC purpose built for software 3.0. And it's exciting to hear from the capital providers who make this possible what their perspective is on how we're going to make a new kind of software with good design and good engineering.
Great to be here.
Last, and of course not least, we have William Pienaar, who created Feast and then worked at Tecton. So some familiar names maybe for folks in the MLOps community. And Willem is currently founding in Stealth. So we'll see whether he can share anything, maybe blink twice if you have a secret to share.
Maybe not yet, but hey, Charles, and hey, everybody.
Great. Thanks for coming, everybody. I'm really excited about this panel. I think with large language models, we are now about a year into this kind of hype cycle. And we've spent a good chunk of that in what Alan Cooper, the interaction design guy, the father of Visual Basic, would call the dancing bear phase of technology. Where like the exciting thing is not how good the product is, but the fact that it can do anything at all, like a bear that can dance. So the kind of theme that I want to talk about here is how do we move out of it? And in the past, with GUIs in the 80s, with browsers in the 90s, with mobile in the 2000s, 2010s, it has always required both product and design sense and technical and engineering sense to like get out of that phase into something that both like works, is like technically sound, but is also a good product. To start off, let's talk about some of the successes in using LLMs in products or as products. So I'm curious, maybe starting with Sarah, with your broader perspective up there on the heights of venture, where have you seen LLMs or LLM-powered products succeed? And what do you think were some of the key aspects that came from the design side or the technical side that made them successful?
Yeah, I mean, I'd start with the premise that these are the reason that this era is different at all is because we have general technologies that are applicable to many downstream tasks. And I think what we've sort of seen in this first year is the new capabilities we get out of them are easier to use in real environments in some tasks than others, right? We tend to think of it in like a few different framings. One would be like how robust is the task to error. Another is just like how much work is in a particular task is automatable sort of end-to-end with the reasoning models and the generations we can do today. And so some of my favorite examples are actually in like wildly different areas, right? So you have people, I think like there are a lot of companies in this area now, but people who are trying to automate end-to-end workflows in the legal world because it's a lot of text in, text out, right? You email the client, you read a document, you summarize the document, you try to reason with a particular framework, you generate legal motions, right? Like, models can do so much of this now. And I think there are other professions that look a lot like text generation, right? Code is a form of text generation. We're just progressing along that dimension. And another sort of field that I think surprised many of us has been media creation, right? I think everybody attending this conference will have spent some time with Midjourney, but I've been super excited about the progress that's happened in video generation, just because it's so useful from, it's expressive and it's useful commercially. So everything from Runway to Pika to HeyGen, which is like virtual avatars and translation, that really sort of crossed a quality floor over the last 6 months.
Yeah. So you mentioned text generation, media generation, and with a lot of focus on like robustness and quality. So I'm hearing a lot from you that's very much on the like technical capabilities side. I'm curious, focusing on those two examples of text media generation, maybe, does anybody have any thoughts about particular product innovations that have like allowed those to cross over from cool tech demo to usable product that people will like pay for or be able to deploy confidently at scale?
I can talk a little bit about that. Like, especially I have seen, with all these great technologies coming up, there's one advancement which has happened is the compute, right? And how we are able to compute these things. Of course, GPUs are much more capable of now training the models at scale, and you have all these different things. But one advancement which I'm seeing is the no-code platform. So up until now, if you have to train the models, it has been like a very big task in itself. Like, you need to have the right kind of infrastructure in place, but also you have to have the right kind of data set, and then the whole training process itself and how long it would take. All of that is a very tedious process, right? If you have to train the model from the scratch, or if you want to fine-tune it from an existing model. But now the no-code platforms, which are evolving, and there are many, many of those, and almost every company have some variant of that, if you see, right? Including Amazon and Microsoft have some variant of that. It's now helping us. It's like becoming no-brainer. The bar is becoming so low, like, okay, you come, you select a base model, you select or upload your own data set, you select whatever parameters you want to adjust, and then boom, you have this training pipeline running in the background, and now you have a model which you are able to now test it out. So I'm really seeing that as a breakthrough in the industry, because that's helping anyone and everyone to come and try out a variant and then see how the model is working. That is also opening up opportunities in the community to have a lot more OSS models out there for people to try it out and explore, and building that infrastructure and ecosystem.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Did you want to take over?
I just want to add on that as well, that one of the things you basically ask what enabled this revolution in many ways, the ability to have these larger data sets of text. For example, GPT-3 was trained on like Common Crawl and this kind of data set. So having more data, also well curated, you want one of those catalysts to what we see today with all these amazing language models.
Definitely.
From a commercialization standpoint, I mean, it's hard to ignore the big players, right? Like GitHub, Copilot, Midjourney, and just ChatGPT. They're low-level, at least in ChatGPT's case, it's a low-level abstraction, but it is such a powerful tool. And if you learn how to prompt it, you've seen the large amounts of money flowing into these services. Mm-hmm. Of course, GitHub Copilot has many years head start in front of many other folks. But we're obviously seeing a lot of new products being developed, but those are the obvious ones.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think it surprised some people that ChatGPT was such a huge explosion relative to the GPT-3 API. But I think if you've sat a non-technical person down in front of something like the Playground or the API versus the chat interface, it's like it's night and day. So I'm wondering maybe from Shamala, you've worked a lot on voice assistants in particular. So I'm curious, what have you seen that are the kinds of like unintuitive or surprising or high leverage changes to these voice assistants, that it's not necessarily just about their engineering capabilities, their latency or whatever, but the actual sort of like product design, the whole product thinking that makes them sticky or better?
Yeah. I mean, if you look at, and that's a very good question. So if you look at the traditional way of designing, I mean, in my mind, when you're designing a digital assistant, a lot of different generative AI capabilities are there. I mean, I don't like to call it like conversational AI, but I like to call it generative AI because ASR is a kind of generative AI, like, you know, speech to text or text to speech is. So digital assistants in general, the traditional way, the way it used to work was this some sort of speech recognition system, which would, you know, interpret what you are saying. And then there was the understanding. That is where, you know, a lot of advancements has happened. We used to have NLP and it was very much rule-based. You had intent-based and you would have a couple of utterances tied to an intent and you would say like, okay, if the user is asking this, these are the different utterances and it would not go beyond that. So there was some advancement which happened eventually like, yeah, so for example, will it rain in Seattle? Do I need an umbrella? Or what's the weather? In users' mind, they all meant the same thing, but it was not very natural for us to, or the language models to have that kind of capability. And we had to, you know, tune to each of these different utterances. I still remember those days where I used to collect these utterances from users through different mechanisms and then feed it into the system and train the model. That has changed. So large language model in my mind is like a wrapper around the conversational AI technology, but in an advanced way. So now it's so much open, it's able to understand because it has so much, you know, knowledge from different sources. It is able to interpret the intent without I having to, you know, manually feed the intent. Mm-hmm. Now, the other advancement which has happened, so when I used to work for Ford Motor Company, one of the challenges we had back then was we had this huge owner manual, right? And then if we have to voiceify or voice enable or make these you know, owner's manual as a conversational assistant thing, I can chat about it or I can talk about it. Believe me, it was very complicated with all the things. Like we had a lot of manual effort back then to be able to create a bot out of or the knowledge base out of that owner's manual. Now with the advancement with the RAG and the, you know, all these different things coming together, I feel like it is becoming much more easier. You are able to feed all these different knowledge sources to the system and it is able to, you know, generate the answers based on that. So that is really going to be the next big thing, especially in the digital assistant world, because it takes away the effort of someone having to manually do all the effort, which was the case back in like a couple of years back.
You know, I think while we're talking about assistants, I think it is like Sam Altman who said, like, we're trying to replicate the median human. And I think in the voice assistant space, or generally with assistants and like personified bots, it's not clear to me people want the median human, right? They want either the best M&A lawyer, or they want Elon Musk, or they want their personalized version. Right. They want like their AI. And so, you know, I think one of the things that has been really interesting to see, you know, piggybacking on what was just said is there's so much to do in terms of development of empathy. Right. Like media richness, like voice and video interrupts fluidity of speech. And then also on the sort of more model development side in terms of like personalization, memory, skills, like things the assistants can do. And so, you know, I'm an investor in Flexion, also great companies like Character out there. I don't know that we're going to end up with median human versus like experts and personalization. And like, you know, humans are interested in individuals, right?
I think there's a tendency to say it's a median human because the models hallucinate. And so we're trying to say, okay, there's an expert and the expert can judge the quality of the system. But really, I think, Sarah, you're right. There's a new class of product that can still fulfill the job to be done. Let's say it's a legal team and they've got some problem. But what you want is a assistant that can scan millions of documents where a human couldn't have done that before. So the breadth and perhaps even the depth can go and find correlations between documents that a human would never be able to find. So you'd be augmenting your team and unlocking new possibilities with these products.
Yeah, actually, exactly about that. What I usually see with like median human kind of LLM applications and really great applications is everything around evaluation. So they have the capability already. It's mainly either on the application not being written in a good enough way, which then leads to hallucinations. So teams that do it really well usually have a whole evaluation set, a whole data set that allows them to constantly monitor and make sure that the performance they see is actually what they expect, and then iterate on that. And that's what usually takes from a medium human kind of level to an expert level.
So it seems that this personalization with the like successive character.ai, for example, this like personalization is clearly like a pattern that can be applied in other places. I'm wondering if people have any thoughts on other patterns or anti-patterns that they've seen in the creation of like an LLM-powered feature or an LLM-powered product.
Yeah, I think that everything that involves latency is really challenging for everyone. So, I mean, probably the one of the hardest intersections is latency and user-facing and open-ended. So many companies building open-ended chat or interfaces that behind the scenes we have LLM-powered apps, it's really difficult to make sure that we see the experience or we have the experience we expect to have. So again, having this evaluation data sets really helps. But also latency is a big challenge. So how do you make sure you want to get great performance? So you may have like multiple prompts and multiple techniques like chat verification from Meta and the like, but you also want to make sure the experience is really fast. So if you have, let's say, a chatbot, I think Stripe, we launched these Stripe docs that allow you to ask questions and for the documentation, then how do you make sure that the experience is fast enough, but at the same time, you don't see hallucinated text? So I think Microsoft had one of those examples with Sydney. When they just launched, people would play with the chatbot, and then they got all these awful results sometimes. And then after a few weeks, or I think even days, they deployed this update that after you get a generation, there is another prompt running behind the scenes asking if the generated answer is actually not harmful or biased and the like. And if so, it literally like deletes the answer. So there are many ways to circumvent like latency and also maintain performance, but it's definitely a challenging space.
Yeah. I think that particular example is one I saw a lot of people pretty upset about. To see an answer appear and then like suddenly disappear feels a little bit dystopian. So that's one of my favorite examples of an anti-pattern for how to solve that problem with latency versus correctness and checking.
Yeah, maybe I'll mention two different patterns I think are kind of interesting. One's in a company that we invested in, and one is just something that like we're continually looking for that we think will work. So a common issue is that humans are like not that good at prompt writing or specifying exactly what they're looking for, right? And so an example I'd use is we're investors in this company, Seek.ai. They use, among other technologies, like SQL generation from natural language to enable business users to ask questions of structured data sources like the warehouse. But as you might imagine, like any company that has a reasonable amount of data, 16 data teams, the idiosyncrasies of like how they actually transform their data and like what, you know, customer count means in this department versus the other department means, it's actually very hard to go from a general, usually underspecified question from a business user to the right generation, right? Like the SQL is actually not, like we can be best in class, but that is not actually the hard part. So the pattern I think is kind of interesting is companies figuring out like what is the workflow to be predictive, right? Like use, for example, like, you know, query generation or ranking technologies or iteration with the end user to get better specification about what they're trying to do versus expect every end user to be good at, well, essentially prompt engineering, right? So I think that's one interesting frontier that people are working on. Another is like everybody loves Copilot, but Copilot is at once like one of the most like very limited and also crazy ambitious things to try to do, right? We work with Alex Gravely, who's onto a new mission, and he's the chief architect at Copilot. And he's like, well, like the dominant feature, we've talked a couple times about latency, but it was like, you know, if I type 100 words per minute, like you got to stay ahead of me to be useful. Like that's a pretty tight latency bound for anything that is LLM powered. And that also means like, you know, you're doing like almost synchronous autocomplete with local context. Like that is not all we need to do in software engineering. And so particularly in these areas where There's been some, you think it'll, there's like going to be success in the modality. I think the interest in trying to do more things asynchronously and figure out how to come back, like go run a job, right? You know, if you're an engineer, you work my team, like you go do something and you come back to me and say like, I figured it out, or I didn't, or I have a question, right? And so I think that there's both like product and research effort around how can I sort of use to some degree, the scalability that Willem described to go try more things, do test time search, like, you know, try and compile code and then come back and tell a user like, oh, I did more for you. And it's like, let me notify you that something's happening or gather more data. And I think there's going to be more emphasis on sort of the more asynchronous patterns as well.
I think a different way to put that is, where do LLMs really annoy people and suck? It's if you put them on the critical path and you put them synchronously in front of the user on a job that they're familiar doing, but where there's writing code, there's a GitHub Copilot on the side, it's additive, it comes in and makes a suggestion, but you can quickly glance and say, you know, you're crazy, I'm going to ignore you, and I'll continue doing my job. I think that applies to almost all use cases. Like, humans have a specific way of doing things, and you just incrementally introduce yourself. And then as these co-pilots move closer to pilots, you know, we'll defer more to them. But for now, they're still hallucinating and they're very slow. And so as that improves, we'll, you know, hand over more.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think a lot of the time for that kind of asynchronous communication or that ignorable communication, it's like text-based or visual. You know, it's a toast that says, hey, maybe you want to do this, or the ghost text in co-pilot.
Related to this, sorry, one more point is like the fatigue that I think will set in. So even in code generation, if as humans, we're going to constantly be reviewing the agents. So this is the tech code generation, like that can become very overwhelming to engineers, right? Like it could become taxing. And so you want that accuracy bar to be high, or you want to introduce the agent in a way that is perhaps reviewing your code and not you reviewing its code.
If you 10x the amount of code to review, you 10x the amount of code review to do, which people don't talk about when they talk about boosting productivity.
Yeah.
The question I was going to ask to Shamala was, with audio, that's like something that really captures your attention. It's like, you know, even a tiny glitch in audio is like something that you just immediately snap onto. So I'm curious, do you have any thoughts about how this sort of like asynchrony or this like, you know, deferral might work with something like a voice assistant? Does it have like, can it call you on a cell phone, or how else can it achieve that phenomenon?
So your voice kind of broke in between. If you could just repeat it, I don't know what's happening with my internet. So yeah,
incredible, an audio issue while talking about the trouble.
Exactly, audio issue. That's why we're talking about.
Yeah. So a text assistant can like, you know, pop up a notification or do ghost text, and that allows it to fade into the background. But for audio, it's not obvious to me how you would do that. And I don't think I've seen that pattern with anything like, you know, Alexa just like interrupts my family dinner if I happen to say its name. So I'm curious if you've thought at all about how that like asynchrony or you know, fading into the background and co-piloting might work for audio.
So audio is just one part of it. I'm glad you brought it up, because I talk about some of these things in my book, Emotionally Engaged Digital Assistant, right? Like where I'm trying to bring all of these things together, understanding personalization. So in my mind, you know, it's all about affordances, like how it should not always be proactive. Like, you know, every time I'm saying, Alexa, do this, you know, it will do it, right? But in certain cases, it is very, you know, proactive in the sense, like if something, you know, it's giving me gestures, this. Multimodality, even in that context, you have like different devices. So I feel like that's very important, like how the feedback or notification is coming when I'm doing a certain task. And especially with all the different kind of automations I'm able to do around, you know, for example, I'm able to send the entire schedule for my day saying, you know, at this time, I want this to happen. At this time, I want this to happen. And then, you know, like set up an alarm, turn on my AC or whatever, you know. I'm also setting up my routine nowadays. How does that happen? Right? How is the user getting notified the job is done? Or how does the user know what's happening? Sometimes there's audio cues, sometimes there's visual cues, sometimes there's some notification, sometimes it's just like, you know, everything done, now this is the task. So I feel the same kind of pattern will be leveraged in the world of co-pilots as well.
You mentioned multimodality in your response, and that's something that, like, looking a year or two ahead, once GPT-4V is generally available and once other proprietary model providers and open models have caught up in capabilities, is a clear big win. Does anybody have any examples of products that take advantage of that multimodality that they have either seen a demo of that they want to share?
We have a product called Neva, the Nemo Vision Assistant. It is a multimodal model, and OpenAI just launched a multimodal as well. So with this model, it's available for trying out. You can go to our playground, NVIDIA AI Playground, and try it out as well. What this does is it's an image and text understanding model. So it's not just generating all the things what we spoke about, like text to text, but it is able to take an image, and it is able to, so if I have uploaded an image and I ask it, like, hey, describe that image, the model is able to describe the image for me. If I just give the image and say, write a story based on the subject of the image or the pattern of the image, the model is also able to do those things, right? Mm-hmm. And the model is able to work standalone, in the sense, like, I can just have text, and I can use it as a LLM, any text-to-text model. Or I can use it in a combination with text and image, and it is able to generate and give me responses based on whatever the subject line of the image might be. That is one level of a multimodality, which really is interesting. I don't think about multimodality like, yeah, I mean, just generating an image kind of context, but I think about it more on the utility standpoint, like how it is helping the users, right? Mm-hmm. And that's very interesting, because think about people who have accessibility issues. If right now, everything which we have, even when I'm posting on LinkedIn or somewhere else, I have to add the alt text so that people who are using screen readers, they are able to actually understand what I uploaded. Otherwise, they will not know what's happening. But multimodality can change the dynamics in that context completely. I don't have to. The LLM is capable of doing that for me. So it's very descriptive. So even a person who have any kind of disability or want to understand what's happening in the context, what's the image and all, they are able to get much more information than an alt tag which I will write, which will be like a person sitting on the bench. That's it, right? Yeah. That is the kind of thing. So I'm thinking about the multimodality in that context, and it feels great what it can do for the advancement of the industry or the community.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm also adding on that, maybe like the first part is about what does it mean for like product and engineering and design in that sense. So the first one, unlike maybe text, we should remember that multimodality usually involve video, audio, which are more expensive to compute, but also store, which is going to change probably profit margins and also latency constraints that are already quite challenging even with text at the modality. Mm-hmm. And then the kind of product that I've seen doing it relatively well. So I think multimodality done well is one that you don't really feel there is like multiple modalities behind the scenes. So in a way, Google's generative search experience is one example where you write text or a prompt and you get multiple results based on video and image behind the scenes. And then two areas I think that are currently going to explode once multimodality gets there. I mean, the first one is everything around content generation. Like imagine we can create TikTok videos like seamlessly. Like if we use like 11 labs or combine it with Sono and like all these other amazing products to generate our videos without all the efforts currently associated with that. And the second part is, I think, Charles, we talked about a few weeks ago, with everything around robotics, right? So robotics is also having its moment. So once you can combine like vision and other sensory signals, you can do some amazing stuff with robotics as well.
I think one of the things going back to making it easier for It's not necessarily focused on multimodal understanding in the sort of final, more extreme sense, but the ability to take richer user input versus expecting everything to be text, I think is really powerful, right? And I'll give you a few examples. And Sahar just made me think of this, right? If you, and being very use case specific is very impactful. So for HeyGen, like, You could, as a user, like string together a bunch of things and say, like, okay, I'm going to use LMNT, I'm going to use 11 to, do speech to text and then do text to speech in a different language and then like try to match it up with the sort of video avatar models that allow us to match like lip movements and motions, right? Or a product company could do that for you, right? And there's definitely research involved in designing models to interact well that way. But I think the fact that now, like what users want to do is just give you video in one language and get video out in a different language. That works perfectly. Mm-hmm. So I think that's one example. Another example would be something like Pika being able to, create video from a given image. It allows for much simpler controllability than text, right? And we've also seen people figure out how to go back and forth with editing that. Managing structure in images and videos is still very challenging, right? Mm-hmm. So what's a smart product person way to go handle this? Well, integrate with workflow tools that allow you to manage structure, right? That could be a Photoshop or a 3D modeling tool. Change the structure in a very specific way, and then re-render, for example, right? And so that I think there are lots of interesting product innovations happening right now to allow people to end users to get the outputs they want in more intuitive ways, which includes like editing and input in different modalities.
Mm-hmm. All right. I think that's all the time that we have for this panel. So I want to thank Shamala, Sahar, Willem, Sarah. Really great conversation. A lot of very distinct but complementary perspectives on how we're going to make useful products out of large language models and large multimodal models in the future. Thanks a lot.
Thank you very much, everybody. And Charles, thank you for being such an excellent host and moderator. Yeah.